My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing to prove.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Mormon Expression Voices. This is Heather, and tonight I have a different story to tell you or have someone else share with you than I have presented on Voices so far. And we'll just go ahead and dive right into that. My guest for today is Flip. Hello, Flip.
Hello.
Do you want to use your last name or just...
Yeah, that's fine.
Flip Johnson.
Yeah.
Can I ask if Flip is your real first name?
No, and it's not even my real middle name. this actually gets in right to the start of the story. I get the super classic Mormon heritage narrative. My patrilineally, the Johnsons, joined up 1830 New York, and you know, they're part of history. One of my boys was mentioned in a Mormon Expression podcast, Benjamin Franklin Johnson. One of the better attested stories of Joseph Smith going and asking somebody about marrying the sister, the whole eternal covenant, all that stuff. Uh-huh. Benjamin, his is one of the most commonly cited journal entries. And then my mom is a convert from Brazil.
Okay.
She was born in Brazil, and she was part of that gigantic wave of converts that happened in the 60s. My dad served his mission in Brazil, I think, in the mid-60s, but in a completely different part of the country.
So it wasn't like she was a missionary bride?
No, nothing like that. She and her sister and her mom converted, I think, in the late 60s, early 70s, and because of that, my mom ended up coming to BYU like so many of them did.
Yeah.
And that's where she met my dad.
Okay.
That's how I came to be a Mormon. Got a miracle story about how she joined the church, because the branch down there in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, needed an organist, and the branch president prayed for somebody to play the piano, and then the missionaries knocked on my mom's door, and she's a brilliant pianist, and so she's been playing organ for the church ever since.
Big family?
There's four of us. I'm the third one. Big brother, big sister, myself, and little sister. Boy, girl. Very Prussian. All about 2 years apart. Super, super classic Mormon. Up to there. And then everything kind of falls apart as far as the classic Mormon family goes. Because our family life was bizarre.
How was it bizarre?
Well, my parents are crazy people. And that's fine. I've learned to deal with that. I realized very, very young that our family was not like other families. It was just emotional chaos in every direction. Everybody, I'm sure, meant the best, but it was kind of a big mess. In fact, I even remember, you know, being very young when they teach you that in the pre-existence, you chose your parents.
Yeah.
And I remember being really, really messed up by that. It's like buying a car, like, oh, well, we can offer you a crazy Brazilian woman and a neurotic American dad. And I should have been like, well, let me see what the guys all across the street are offering before I dive into this one. You know, it really did mess with me, because I'm like, wait, I chose this. This is something I chose. And it's just one of the many, many, many ways that the Mormon guilt machine operates, I think. It's just that classic thing that if things aren't going right in your life, it's either you're doing it wrong,
mm-hmm.
or God's testing you. And either way, what the hell? What
right.
can you do? What are you supposed to do? You know, because my dad, he was inactive. He was a Jack Mormon, basically. As Jack Mormon as you can get, very much into history and always has been. So I grew up knowing about the Mountain Meadows Massacre and all the polygamy. Of course, I mean, I came from a polygamist. My great-grandpa was the youngest child of the third wife of his dad. You know, Adam God theory, all that stuff. That wasn't news to me. Like, I went out into the mission field and explained to other elders that, no, that thing that Jehovah's Witness, yeah, that's true. That's something that happened in Mormonism.
Uh-huh.
But he never went to church. And then on the flip side, my mom was devout. She was a rock. Kind of part of the whole thing that made my family life so messed up was that there's kind of this common narrative. The reason everything was bad and that we were poor and that we were unhappy and everything else was that because my dad didn't go to church and didn't pay his tithing and didn't do all these other things.
He wasn't an upstanding priesthood leader.
Yeah, and, you know, like I was baptized or I think my dad baptized me. He probably shouldn't technically have, but, you know, but then my uncle ordained me to a deacon.
Uh-huh.
You know, most of our ordinances were performed by one of my uncles because my dad couldn't do it. And it was great shame. Because, you know, my dad, he had four siblings. You know, two of them had nine kids apiece. Most of my aunts and uncles and cousins and all that, they are the Mormon paragon families. Nine kids, everybody mission college, doctors, lawyers, television producers, the whole bit, everything, all attractive, intelligent, mm-hmm. charming people, you know? Mm-hmm. And then we were the odd family out, because we were lower class screwballs from Kearns. Of course they loved us, and they invited us to Christmas, and they were always nice and all that stuff. They were absolutely family, but there was definitely this thing of Dad needs to get back in church, and you guys need to be in church, and you guys need to fix this, because that's why you guys are unhappy or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
About 12, I was ordained a deacon, and then from there, I basically kind of dropped out of church. I just didn't want to go, because I hated it, always. It's boring, everybody knows that, and it's a trip, you know, which wasn't too hard. I mean, my mom always gave a lot of resistance, but in my family, there was no idea, like, discipline, or you have to do this, or you have to do that. My mom would just kind of guilt trip us like crazy. And I was still Mormon, like, I believed in it, but... You know, through junior high and high school, I basically didn't associate with Mormons. They bored me.
So you were about 12.
Yeah.
And you checked out because it wasn't intellectually stimulating, rather than like, this is hokey, this is ridiculous, I don't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, church was boring, and you don't learn anything there. Church was 3 hours bored and depressed on a Sunday morning that I could be asleep. The other thing is that, like, the kids in my ward that were my age, they were the guys that were going to church and passing the sacrament and doing all that crap, and I knew that they were shoplifting, sleeping with girls, all this other stuff. And the ones that were, you know, not doing those things were just kind of boring kids. And so I always hung out with the lowlifes and misfits, and I even ended up going to a alternative high school, because it was kind of a way to check out of high school in a half-assed way, because you only had to go to school half the day and all that. You know, I hung out with the kids and that drank and all that, and I'd hang out with them while they drank and smoked, and I would give them a bunch of grief about it and occasionally sample things, and I'd never get drunk because I figured if I taste it, that's okay.
Taste is okay, but drunk is a sin?
I definitely felt guilty about it, but not terribly guilty. My mom was raised in Brazil. She told us that she loved coffee. I mean, she's Brazilian, coffee, Brazil, and she loved coffee, but she mm-hmm. never drank it. Not once since 1970-something did she ever drink coffee, but she would eat coffee candies, because, well, that's just a coffee candy. And she loved beer. When I was 6 years old, I would beg my mom to buy O'Doul's. And she would buy de-alcoholized beer. And it was slightly scandalous, I mean, but we worked it all out. No, it's not against the word of wisdom, it's de-alcoholized beer, and we loved it. And I was fascinated. When I was a kid, like, you know, 10, 11, 12, my dad gave me the All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot. They did affect my Mormon worldview in kind of a negative way. They were kind of faith shaking in that...
All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot affected your faith.
Absolutely, and that's kind of what I'm getting to, is that they are the most heartwarming stories. They're as family-friendly as you can get, you know, and James is as real a character. I mean, Tristan, Siegfried, they're these real human beings, and they're everything that a Mormon should be, except they're A, not, and B, they drink and smoke. Right?
Okay.
You know, because like when I was very young, I think like a lot of Mormon kids, you get the idea in your head that people that smoke are bad. People that drink are bad. Right?
Yes.
And here's James Herriot. He's the nicest guy in the world. He's as Mormon can be. And those stories, I mean, there's nothing other than the drinking, other than the word of wisdom issues. He's the paragon of Mormon living, right? It was a problem for me, because I remember like, wait a second, Tristan drinks. And that's the thing, that's what I'm getting to with the beer and why I was so curious about it, was that I remember as a kid reading, there's somewhere in one of the stories where they need to celebrate something, and Tristan starts listing off all of the different pubs in the vicinity and describes their beers. And he's talking about, I know, this one has a nutty, malty thing. I just remember thinking, like, there's this whole world of beer, and it sounds amazing, and I want to try it. So, yeah, and I'd hang out with all the kind of weirdos and lowlifes, and was kind of the weird Mormon kid. You know, I mean, I'd hang out with the goths and the skaters and everything else, and I didn't hang out with the Mormons. When I was 18, 19, my cousins that are about my age, one of them was going on his mission, and it was at his farewell. And I just broke down, started bawling, and I had this moment that I have to fix my life, because I was just horribly depressed. And I was just kind of floating there, and I basically felt like I was unlovable, unlikable, and that I was a complete wreck, you know, and also I had the problem that I was not worthy. Doesn't sound like me, but when I was 15, I lost my virginity in what was an awkward, awful way, which is, I think, the only way that Mormons that are 15 could. And that shook me up badly, because I was kind of already inactive then, but I thought that people could see it on my face.
That you were a sinner.
That it was like a thing clicked in me, and that, oh crap, that's it. I am cut off.
They can no longer see his image in your countenance.
Yeah, my countenance is gone, and the thing is, and it's the sin next to murder, right?
Right.
It's not like I got attention from girls. It's not like there was a lot of temptation. It was insane that it even happened. And I felt so... I mean, it it racked me, you know, from then until, I guess, 3-4 years. And so I had this moment, probably the only spiritual experience I ever had. I decided that I have to fix my life. I have to do this. And I decided to go on my mission. Because, you know, that's the other thing. Is my dad had gone on a mission. Most of my cousins, boys and girls, had gone on missions. And, of course, you know, in
Your
Mormonism...
Brother.
My brother went on his mission to Chile. It's the rite of passage into manhood. And
yes.
As a Mormon, if you don't go on a mission, then, you know, you might as well put a big red X on your head that said, you know, loser or something.
Yeah, you're treated differently the rest.
Yeah.
Well, at least until you get married and have children. You said you had a spiritual experience, though.
Well, I mean, I was sitting in the very back of the ward house while my cousin was giving his farewell speech, and I just, right there, I started bawling, I started crying, and I had this resolution. I'm gonna go clear my thing up with the bishop. I had to go into the bishop's office to get cleared up, to get back worthy, and then, you know, temple recommend, go mission application, all that stuff. Before or since have I ever had such devotion and single-mindedness to a task? And I'm really kind of sad that I couldn't find that same determination about school or anything else, because between that moment and the time I finally shipped out on my mission, I don't know, maybe a little under a year, I saved money. I was working. I saved money to buy as much of my mission stuff as I could and got everything clean, went to church every week, got a calling, read the Book of Mormon and a bunch of other stuff, and absolutely got myself ready to go, and I put my chips down. I took the bet. I was convinced that the mission would turn me into a happy man. I would go into it and I would come out fixed.
Okay, where'd you go?
California Roseville Mission, which was the first big disappointment. More than anything, I wanted to learn another language. I wanted to go sleep in a ditch in Madagascar or, you know, in an igloo in Siberia. I wanted to go to the weirdest, wildest place possible. And, you know, for one thing, I'd been praying and I'd been so good and I'd gotten everything together and I'd been so devoted. I'm a smart guy and I have a knack for languages and I was raised bilingual. And I figured, you know, God knows me. He's going to send me to learn Hmong or something or okay. Russian or anything,
Icelandic,
you know?
Whatever.
Icelandic, because I mean, I've got a knack for languages, all that stuff. And I remember in the MTC, it made me so mad when the elders would be like, oh, I was so scared they would send me to Mexico. You bastard. I would have killed to go to Mexico. I thought for sure they'd send me to Brazil just because I already spoke the language and I have citizenship there. And at that time, they were being real jerky about giving the missionaries visas. And I was kind of prepared for the disappointment of going to Brazil. But instead, I opened up my mission cons. It's one time zone over in Northern California. I tell people I'm going to Northern California and they all say, oh, you're going to love it. The redwoods and the coastal mountains, Fort Bragg, and the Pacific Coast, and then there's the Sierras, and the Shasta, and all that great stuff. Our mission was the Sacramento River Valley, which is called the armpit of California, appropriately, and it was big, and flat, and hot, and there's nothing to look at, and geographically, as far as a place to go, it's just hell, it was just awful, I mean, there's nothing there, but so I went out there, and it was English-speaking.
Well, before we get into your mission, in that time between when you made the resolution to go on your mission and when you went on your mission, you were praying, you were going to church, paying your tithing, did you feel like you were receiving spiritual benefit? Did you even question it?
I don't know, because I always, always, always had a very big problem with praying. I could not shake the feeling that I was just bouncing thoughts off of my skull. Not to mention the whole conundrum of like, well, wait a second, so God's just gonna do what he's gonna do anyway, and also, doesn't he already know my thoughts and desires and feelings? Like, do we really need to have this communication? He already know. it was always really, really difficult. I think I was happy because I had a direction. And I mean, that's one thing about the mission. The only thing that is kind of nice about the mission, even though, you know, at this point I actually wouldn't want that anymore, but every day you wake up and you know exactly what your purpose is and everything is taken care of. All you have to do is get up and do your job. And you don't have to worry or think about anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's nice, you know, that's comforting in a way. Of course, it was also incredibly constricting. I mean, also, I think everybody was really quite impressed because I was kind of the prodigal son. You know, it was a bit of that. And also, I think, you know, a lot of my extended family were like, oh, wow, I guess that shit had pulled his head out. So I took off on my mission.
Can we talk about the temple first?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, I forgot about the temple. Going to the temple was a blast because, you know, like I said, my dad, you know, told me about Mount Meso, all that stuff. Dad hadn't been to the temple since, I don't know, the early 80s. And, you know, and I went to the temple in 99. And I'd talked to him about it before. And then he told me about the penalties before I ever went to the temple. And he didn't know that they'd been removed. And I was confused that they didn't happen. I was expecting to do that penalties thing, and I was relieved, and I remember asking somebody, like, don't you have to do this thing? And they're like, oh, no, no, we don't do that for the last 8 years.
So you were prepared.
As much as I could be, but it was still definitely extremely strange. Because, I mean, I had an idea, and my dad told me about the handshakes, and they're not really handshakes. And, you know, and also I did all the reading that I could do. That was something I always did. I did a lot of just research on my own. I remember the noted absence of something special. Long before I'd ever gone on my mission, I like to think that the beginning of my apostasy probably happened when I was about 12, and I watched a Nova special, Secrets of the Psychics, with James Randi, where James Randi talks about cold reading and how to bend spoons and all that stuff, and that was my very, very first exposure to critical thinking and thinking errors and biases, all of that. I realized very quickly that, you know, you set a mood, you play some music, everybody's being very somber and serious and dressed up in funny clothes. Of course we feel special, or, you know, of course it feels different from outside. First you hear, like, you go to the temple and you watch a movie, and you're expecting at least a good movie? You know?
Okay.
Like, God, this is really God's production? This is the best you can do?
Was this before, like, the Michael Ballum devil?
I think it was Michael Ballum. Was he the guy who sang opera?
Yeah.
He's the only good character. He's the only good actor and only believable character in
that's
the show.
That's what I've been told. I haven't been to the temple, so I haven't seen it. But that's what I've been told, is they're the one charismatic, interesting individual in the...
He really is. He's also the most human.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess makes sense in the theology, as much as anything can make sense.
So you just saw through it.
I don't know. It's so hard to put yourself back there, because I remember having doubts constantly, and I remember suppressing them and believing. A lot of people have asked me, you know, why'd you leave the church? You know, members are like, what was the reason you left the church? I love how they always think there's one thing.
Right.
And when I try to take everything and condense it down to a sentence, I tell them that throughout my mission, I kept looking for the hand of God, and I couldn't find it anywhere. I got to the MTC, and on my first day, I open up the mission manual, and I start reading it, and I'm 2 pages into it, and it hits me like a ton of bricks. This is a sales manual. Because I'd done sales. I was familiar with sales, and this is exactly how you sell vacuums door to door.
Oh, okay.
You know, you change some of the wording.
Uh-huh.
Like, but it's a sales manual. It absolutely is a sales manual. And they talk about, you know, the whole less effective, more effective, all that crap. And so that was one problem. And then the other thing that happened is, like, you know, I'd read the mission packet tells you about the approved reading list. And my family, we're all very much into books, and I've always been into reading. And in preparation for my mission, I got a whole bunch of books. I got some Hugh Nibley, and I did a bunch of other stuff. And I even brought with me a manual. It's called Religions of the World, and it was actually a textbook for a religion course at BYU. And so I thought, well, there's no way they'd have a problem with this. And my MTC trainer made me send it home. Don't know if I did send it home. I think I lied about that. Because I was like, what do you mean? What, I can't learn about religion? I'm thinking, like, oh, you want me to go out and convert these people? I'm going to find out a little bit about them, thanks. You know, there's a lot of things like that where I'm just like, this makes no damn sense.
So I think that most believers operate under the assumption that, well, it's even like, it was even a line in God's Army. Like, we don't convert people. The Holy Ghost converts people,
yeah.
Right? And you get there and you realize that this isn't just go out and speak the truth and the Holy Ghost will witness to people.
Yeah.
This is how to convince them.
Well, that's what they tell you, that, you know, that the Holy Ghost converts them, not you. But you have to wake up and get out there and do the work, and you got to knock the doors, and you got to give the discussions, you got to hand out the pamphlets, and we're going to ask you once a week how many of each of these things you did, and we're keeping track. You know, it's one of those cognitive dissonance, one of those many paradoxes in the church. Also, one of the great ironies of the mission field is that Sundays is the hardest working day for missionaries, which I always tell them, wait, but didn't they?
That's Sabbath, yeah.
Yeah, and the whole thing, no, this is the day we don't work, but it was always the hardest day. The MTC experience was kind of extra bad for me, too, for a couple of reasons. One is that our district, my MTC district, I think was kind of cursed. There was 8 elders, we all went to Roseville, and 4 sisters that went to Michigan. 3 of the sisters went home early, and I think 4 or 5 of our elders went home early, and I didn't finish honorably. Just at the finish line, I fell. So then we were kind of cursed, and it was just a big mess there. I mean, one of the guys kept wanting to go home.
And, at the MTC?
At the MTC, yeah. And then what compounded it, and this was another one of those things where, you know, like I said, looking for the hand of God, I couldn't see how the mission field and the mission office and everything else was any, in the MTC, was any different from any other organization or business or school or anything else I'd ever been a part of. And it's all supposed to be run by revelation, and, you know, the mission president's got aligned to God, all this stuff. And while I was at the MTC was when they were changing their policy to where UVU students could no longer teach at the MTC. Because it used to be that you had to be a returned missionary and a full-time student at BYU or UVSC, UVU I guess it is now. So while I was there, they were in the middle of firing half of their teachers and breaking their hearts in the process. Like, three of my teachers cried saying, this is the last class I'm teaching and they're firing me. And they were all confused as to why. And it was just one of those stupid, arbitrary, classic Mormon
bureaucratic policy changes
that, you know. And so instead of having three MTC teachers, I had nine angry, depressed ones, you know. And so the MTC for me was just extra double hell, and I just could not wait to get the hell out of there.
Did the structure feel oppressive?
Oh, yeah. Although part of, I think, how the MTC operates is that they don't give you time to think. It's just go. It's just go, go, go. And then on top of that, I was, and for as long as I could remember, I was an insomniac. I couldn't fall asleep. And in the MTC, you know, you're awake at 6 a.m. and you're off and running and there ain't no sleeping in. Mm-hmm. That's not a thing. And every night I'd just be awake until 2 or 3. By the end, I was just a zombie. You know?
So the getting up early and running until you drop.
Nine, yeah.
Did not cure the insomnia.
No, that was one of the many things. Like, you know, I kind of had this very privately to myself, this kind of list of things that the mission was going to help me with. I'd tell people, like, I'm an insomniac, I can't sleep. And they all say, you're lazy or you're depressed. It's either of those things, or in the Mormon paradigm, have you been praying? You know, whatever. Like, you're God's keeping you up or something, you know? And so I kind of thought, okay, God, I'm going to go. Like, this is the thing, right? I do the thing you command me to do, and then I get blessings, right? That's the bargain. Except you can't actually word it like that, because then that jinxes it or something? I don't know. So, and I, you know, thought, all right, this MTC thing, you know, this is just a show. I'm going to get out of this. I'm going to get to the mission field. And
then you'll see the hand of
God. That's when things are going to happen. And boy, that didn't happen. I get out there, and I meet my trainer, Elder John, we'll call him. He messed me up in a big, bad way, because I got out to the mission field, and I was already feeling like a failure. Nobody liked me. Nobody could love me. I was a bad Mormon. I was a bad missionary. I was a bad person.
You were still feeling that way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, because I still am an asshole. I'm abrasive and opinionated and loudmouthed and all that, and I was only infinitely worse back then. And my trainer, he was narcissistic and hypocritical and thought was receiving revelations. He was finishing his mission. I was killing him in the mission lingo. And he had it in his head that he was the wise old veteran and I was the young green that had to be molded. And he ran me ragged. I was as fat as I'd ever been and as out of shape as I'd ever been when I arrived in the mission field. And by the end of the mission, I'd lost 90 pounds, and 60 of those were probably in that 3 months with Elder John. Because that's the thing, is I get to the mission field and I tell him, like, I have not been on a bike for 6 years. Now, he'd been into mountain biking and was a sprinter and all this, and he ran me stupid. I can't really remember all the details, but one day, I don't even remember how it all came up, but we come back from something, I don't know, and he sits me down on the couch, and he tells me, in these words, you are the worst missionary I've ever seen. Nobody likes you. People aren't going to let you into their homes when I'm gone. This area is going to crash and burn when I'm gone. I was still in this mode that, like, he is my trainer. The mission president is inspired, and he was inspired for me to be with his trainer, and this is what I need to hear. For me, I thought, like, maybe it's humility. I need to be humble. I need to be humble. And I tried to be humble, and the only way I could find to do it was to hate myself. It just seemed like everything was conspiring to make that happen. And I was on splits with the Mormon mission leader, and he actually kind of set me down. He's like, are you okay, Elder Johnson? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, I think Elder John was hard on you. And I'm like, you noticed? You know, because I felt like I couldn't complain. I felt like I couldn't say anything because, you know, he's my trainer. And
well, that's part can't of complain. The... John Larson said that if Mormonism's culty, the mission is a cult.
Oh, yes.
So you're kind of programmed into, this is happy, this is fun, this is the most intense experience of my life. And so...
Absolutely.
Like, having problems is not... You just don't do that.
Yeah. So I was falling asleep everywhere. I fell asleep in church. I fell asleep on people's couches because I'm riding 30, 40 miles a day. I'm obviously not drinking any caffeine. Why can't I sleep? And I remember even, you know, going and with my interviews with the president, and he's saying, "What? How are you?" And I'm like, "I'm doing badly. I cannot sleep." And Elder John is on my case because I'm not doing my studying in the morning, and it's just an ongoing problem. At one point I'm just like, I sleep in, and I'll get up about 9, guys, I guess. And people would complain to President. President would get on me. So finally, after telling me to pray that, you know, and I kept trying to explain to him, you know, President, I don't know what else to do. I cannot sleep, and it's a problem. So he finally sent me to see a doctor who was one of the counselors in the mission presidency, who was like a geriatric general practitioner. And he does some blood tests, and he gives me some pills and tells me they're to sleep for sleep. And I take them for a couple of months and don't notice anything. And so I just stop taking them, whatever. And 6 months later, you know, dinner at a member's house, and she was a nurse, and she had one of those, big book of pills. I looked up this pill, and it was Paxil.
He'd given you an antidepressant.
He gave me an antidepressant and told me it was a sleeping pill. At the moment, I'm like, oh, that's kind of odd. And then I look back like, no, that is messed up. You know, if you think I'm depressed, tell me you think I'm depressed, right? So the mission president transfers me down to another area, and he makes me the senior companion of one of the guys that I was in the MTC with. And he had a really hard time. And he was 25 and like 6'5", huge dude. And he was illiterate. And I mean illiterate. He could not read, and he had all kinds of emotional problems and anger management issues and a heart condition, and just had no damn business being on a mission. I think the mission president put me with him because the president knew that I was bookie. And
what does that mean?
Literate. I was literary.
Oh.
Literate.
You're smart.
I did a lot of reading. And when I had my very, very first interview with the president and met him for the very first time, one of the things he has me do is read a paragraph of something. And I found out everybody has to do that. I don't know if this was standard for every mission, but he was finding out who could read and how well. And also, this actually, I had forgotten all about this, and this is something I'm going to throw out to the Mormon Expression podcast world, if anybody else has heard of this, because when I got put with this illiterate elder, the mission president gave me this packet, and it was a learn to read using the Book of Mormon. It was published by the church, and it's for missionaries. And this is where President comes up again, because in the mission field, we had this thing that we called the greenie bubble, and every missionary could tell you when his greenie bubble popped.
Okay.
Because when you go to the MTC, they put you in the greenie bubble. That's where you still believe that the mission world is what it is in Ensign Magazine. And everybody has that experience when they have, like, their moment of realization that the mission field is not at all what anybody told you it would be. And I'm having this interview with the mission president, and, I mean, I'm having a gajillion things going on. There's this whole other thing going on with the whole insomnia thing. And then I'm trying to deal with my companion, who's illiterate, anger management, never wants to leave the house, constantly breaking things, constantly packing up to go home. And I'm just this wreck, and this interview's going on, and I'm trying everything. I'm talking to president every way I can, and I'm just getting nowhere. And at one point, I remember saying, "President, I cannot control how people react." And he says, that's your problem, Elder Johnson. I say, I need to learn to control how people react. And he smiles and he nods. At that moment, my greenie bubble popped. And at that moment, I realized, oh, the mission president doesn't have a line to God. He's just some guy. He's talking out of his ass just like every one of us are, you know?
He has no answer.
He has no answer. And then not only is that not an answer, that's wrong. That makes no sense in Mormon paradigm, non-Mormon paradigm, in any paradigm.
Yeah.
That makes no freaking sense. But the other thing that was interesting is that at the same moment, I learned that the mission president was human in another way. Because, you know, we'd heard rumors early on that the mission president had brought his BMW Z3 with him and had it parked in the garage at the mission home. And one day when I was at the mission home, I went to look at it to see it with my own eyes. And so the mission president tells me I need to learn to control how people react. And I just kind of said, okay, president, let's pray. And I was just like, okay, this interview's done because I'm not getting any answers from that. So we pray. And I'm like, president, just one more thing. That BMW, is that a 6 or an 8? And he said, what are you talking about? I'm like, your BMW, president, is that a 6 or an 8? He's like, I don't know what you mean. I'm like, president, I've seen it. Is that a 6-cylinder or an 8-cylinder? He said, what's a cylinder, Elder Johnson? And I just thought, okay, so not only are you an ordinary human, but just like every one of us, you're bending the rules and smiling about it and laughing about it, because he's not supposed to have his sports car with him, but he did. So about the same time, the mission president finally sends me to go see a therapist through LDS Family Services. And he sends me to talk to this guy who's interning to get his license. And I go see him for like 12 weeks. At one point at the end, he says, you know, Elder Johnson, and he pulls out the DSM-4, and he's like, I think that you have chronic insomnia. And I'm like, what? Because, like, I didn't, you know, I was calling it I Can't Sleep. And I kind of wouldn't allow myself to say insomnia, because if I said insomnia, people say, no, you're lying, or you're just lazy, or you're depressed.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not a kosher problem.
Yeah, it's not a real problem. It's That's kind of like depression. Oh, you're not depressed.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing. And he goes through and he shows me everything, and I'm like, wow. And he says, Elder, I think we might want to consider just sending you home on a medical and send you to a sleep center and to sort this out. How'd you feel about that? And I was like, oh, I don't know about that. And
so not like kicking you off the mission, but just sending you home for some medical
leave
stuff,
yeah.
And then coming back,
yeah. So I go home, I call my mom and talk to her, and she'd actually already gotten a call from the president. And I said, no, I want to stay, because I just thinking, like, what more shameful way to come home from your mission than I can't sleep, you know? Oh, he went home. What happened? Did he get a collapsed lung? Did he get hit by a car? No, he can't sleep. Well, that's the other thing. My MTC companion was, I love that guy. He was a local story when he went on his mission, because he has this thing called Marfan syndrome, and you know, which just
so he has a he's tall and
yeah he was almost as tall as me. I'm 6'3". He was, you know, maybe an inch shorter than me, and he weighed 110 pounds, and you know, and had all kinds of issues, and had every reason imaginable to not go on a mission, and yet he did. So anyway, I didn't want to go home, and I kind of decided not to. And then I found out afterward that by that therapist recommending that, it caused a gigantic ruckus. Found out the mission president hit the ceiling, because that guy recommended that I go home on a medical. And the thing is, the ward that I was in, the Elders Quorum president was this intern's boss. And so, because I go back next week, and they say, oh, you're not seeing so-and-so, you're seeing this other guy. And I asked the guy in the Elders Quorum, I said, was he moved? Was that because of me? And he kind of just nodded.
So it wasn't that they were mad that you didn't go home. It was mad
they were
that
mad,
this guy...
They were mad that he suggested to me that I might have chronic insomnia and that I might need to just go home on a medical to sort it out. That I might have a physiological problem that interferes with the mission work. And so a few months later, after I've been out about 9 months, I get another missionary who I killed him. He was heading home. In my first night with him, 5 hours, I just unload. I basically give him the details of everything up to that point. And this guy was kind of a mission legend. He'd been a zoni for a long time. Super nice guy. Really, really good missionary. But then also I found out was kind of one of the rule benders. You know, and I told him about the whole thing about, you know, I can't sleep. And I'm like, you know, I'm sorry, Elder, but like, I'll try to wake up, but I might just be asleep. And I'm unpacking and I feel like a wreck. And he says, Elder, I'm not going to tell President. And if you can't sleep, sleep in. And just lie to President. And I was like,
what?
Lie to President? Oh, I could just lie to President. Kind of started breaking the rules there a bit. Like, nothing serious, but, you know, the district group would get together after hours, and we'd hit the streets of the suburbs of Sacramento on rollerblades and bikes and that kind of thing. Real wicked, wicked stuff. And also, we ended up watching a lot of movies. We had keys to the church, so we went to the library and got one of those little TV VCR combos, and one of the guys had a Blockbuster membership from New Jersey that actually worked out in California. So, you know, the next companion's on from there. Like, every time I got a new companion, I'd say, like, here's the deal, man. I might be asleep until noon. You can tell President, I don't care. He can send me home if he wants.
And then they just wouldn't tell.
And, yeah, and I'm sure most of them were relieved. They got to sleep in too.
Yeah.
The other big difficulty throughout the whole mission, listening to John Larson's interview, in the mm-hmm. very early one where he talked about it, because he, I guess, was in Southern California a few uh-huh. years before me, and when he describes the fact there's nothing to do.
Yes.
There is nothing to do, and especially in Northern California, that area, not only is there already a big Mormon presence, but in the 80s, that was like the epicenter of the evangelical anti-Mormon movement. Walter Martin, Ed Decker, and Dick Baer all operated out of there. In my first area, there was this like Baptist church that, you know, they showed the Godmakers every Thursday night. So,
did you go see it?
No, I wanted to. We actually thought about renting a copy, but that was, we wouldn't do, we South Park, I guess, was dangerous enough, but we wouldn't watch the Godmakers. But I did meet Dick Baer.
Did you track him?
No, in fact, you know, we broke the rules in two ways. Because obviously, A, we weren't supposed to go visit Dick Baer, and B, he lived out of our area. Because, you know, so many of the mission rules are just bizarre. You know, they don't even make sense. Especially the mission-specific rules. We had a mission rule for our mission only that we were not allowed to ride unicycles.
Because did somebody get hurt?
Because somebody broke an arm riding a unicycle. That's how that works. You know, I remember thinking in the mission manual, because the whole thing was like, you know, no shooting guns from a boat or flying in an airplane or anything else. I just remember thinking, like, somewhere some elder did something stupid, and now they had to put Adeline to the white manual. Well, what was I getting to? I got lost.
Dick Bear.
Oh, yeah, so we go and we tracked into Dick Bear, and he's the nicest guy in the world. He's like, hey, elders, you must know who I am. I'm public enemy number one. And I chatted with him a bit, like, you know, whatever happened between you and Ed Decker. And all that, and he gave me a copy of his Why I Left the Mormon Church. Like, it was, that was not faith-shattering in any way whatsoever, because I'd already read the, like, take heed that you be not deceived, like, the anti-Mormon apologetics, and I've read the, and seen the God Maker since my mission, and it's a joke. Like, it's kind of funny that Mormons are as afraid of it as they are. I guess that a lot of the historical stuff is true, but the thing is, like, I think your average member reading that would just go, like, this is so, such a caricature of Mormonism that's so obviously false.
That it would be easy for
that, yeah, to it's very easy to just go, oh, you're just a wacko. Yeah. And it's the same thing with Dick Bear. He was just a nice old guy who was nuts. Mm-hmm. But kind of got semi-wicked. And once I got to that point where my greenie bubble broke and I just realized I'm going to tell President what he wants to hear. I'm just going to do my best to grind out my mission.
So were you doing any missionary work?
Oh, as much as we could, but... Oh, that's what I was getting at, was the damn boredom. You know, there's one day I recall that all day long, we actually got out, and from 9 to 9, whatever it is, we worked, and we tracted for 3 or 4 hours one afternoon, and literally spoke to no one. And we went to the park, and we went to the business section, and there's just nobody around. And also, not to mention, like I said, everybody's already heard of Mormons. You know, these are the suburbs of Sacramento, where it was basically all super new development of, like, young married working couples. You know, most of them worked in the Bay Area and lived out there, and so there's nobody was home during the day.
Right.
To begin with, you know, there's a couple of times that I'd knock on the door and the housekeeper would answer the door and, you know, say, hi, we're from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we have a message, yada yada. They say, oh, no English. And I say, hola, estamos representantes de la Iglesia. And they just, without breaking eye contact, just slowly close the door.
Because they weren't prepared.
Yeah, because I just bust out a little bit, as much as I could do. Just because I knew it, because I, come on, you know, you can speak English. You know, and there's a couple other, like, detracting. There's, you know, they'd send the kid to the door, where it's like there's a, like, 3-year-old girl, you know, dragging her teddy bear, like, hi, are your mom and dad home?
No.
Yeah, okay. And so while we're leaving, we see a big hairy arm pull the garbage can from around the side of the house. Like, oh, come on, guys. As a missionary, I had a policy that you only had to tell me no once. And I would not bring it up again. And I was a successful missionary. See, that's the thing. It's like, I can imagine, like, your typical Mormons, when they hear about me, like, sleeping in and not praying hard and lying to the mission president and watching South Park. You know, well, no wonder your mission was so miserable. But I was a wildly successful missionary for my mission.
How many baptisms did you have?
The way we counted victories, I qualified for 25. And in my, most of the guys that were out during the 2 years that I was out got maybe 5.
25. I have a friend who I would ask you if you ran into her on your mission, but I know she served after you'd gotten home, just based on your age. She had 1.
Yeah.
And I have heard that going to Northern California is similar to, like, going to, like, France. Like, you're just not going to baptize people.
Well,
you had 25.
Like I said, there's nobody there that doesn't already know a Mormon. Because, like, it's not like, you know, Layton or Calgary or something, but people already knew about us.
Okay, so difficult companions, really struggled, got somebody who understood your need for sleep, started being a sinner in the terms of Mormondom.
Because what happened is I finally stopped worrying about the things that I realized were patently bullshit. Part of the whole greenie bubble thing is realize, like, okay, this part of the mission thing is bullshit. In the mission lingo, we had this thing, it was called handling your junk. It's like missionary streetwise. Can you present everything that you need to present so that you don't get any flack from leadership or president? You know, basically what it was is, like, can you break the rules and be a good missionary? Because this is one of the lies of the mission field, was that, like, you know, really? I slept in till 9 o'clock and now somebody's gonna burn in hell? You know, that's how God works? You know, it makes no damn...
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and the other, like, that kind of thing is, we were, the whole district was getting together one P-Day or something to go out for basketball or something. We're all getting ready to go, And one of the elders, I think it was even the Zoni or something, said, should we say a prayer? And everybody just laughed. Because, like, you know, you're supposed to say a prayer. No, we're getting in a car and go play basketball. Yeah. If God's got our number, he's got our number, right? Really? We don't pray, so that's why, you know,
the truck with
the no brakes wipes us out, you know? You just kind of realize, like, oh, that stuff's all unnecessary. You weren't praying, and you lied to your mission president, and you watched South Park and all that other stuff.
And you had 25 baptisms.
And I had 25 baptisms. And also, I should mention, I guess nobody should mention this, but I did not masturbate for 2 years. Like, when I was a kid, I used to imagine that, like, someday I would, like, climb Everest or, like, you know, jump out of a balloon like Felix Baumgartner. And now I'm just like, I have no, like, that part of me that wants to accomplish some big thing is dead. I that thing where I had to, you fight that battle with yourself and you win it, I won that 700 days in a row. So.
So, but did that come down to the, we were not gonna break the commandments?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And so, like, it's about that point, you know, when 9 months to 15 months were kind of the golden era, I think, of most people's missions. Because the other thing is that I got moved out to way up north in this wonderful little cattle ranching thing. Because I'd spent, like, 9 months in the suburbs of Sacramento, which is, like, living in sandy, only full of Californians. And, and it was just awful. And so I finally got to get out, you know, I was 4 hours away from the mission president. That's the other nice thing. Because the thing is, I think president was keeping me close to home. You know, I figured he was.
Were you kind of labeled a trouble?
Well, the whole thing with the insomnia, yeah. Everything else. And the other thing is that, like, for the first 9 months, I was the only idiotic missionary in the mission being honest with the president because I thought...
That's what you did.
That's what you're supposed to do. He's there to help you, all that stuff. So I got out to Cottonwood, and the mission president put me with, we'll call him Elder Justin. We spend 3 months out there, and we become the bestest pals. We're still super pals to this day. We just had a freaking blast, and he came out like 3 weeks after me. And so we'd been out about the same amount of time, and we both, like, you know, I'd had my whole nightmare thing. He'd had his whole side of this mess. And we really just were, you know, comrades in the foxhole. You know, we did work pretty hard, but we also went to the thrift store and bought a TV for $5, and his brother sent out his PlayStation. We became world champions of Twisted Metal 2. I'm pretty sure that we could have gone professional.
So, did the mission president never come by the apartment?
Usually we could get a heads up and, like, we kind of...
Hide it in a closet.
Yeah, we just generally didn't happen that much. And also we were just good at handling our junk. And so we'd watch The Simpsons and Friends and all that stuff. And we also baptized a couple people. I was a lot happier in the mission field generally. And I was feeling a little bit better. I still felt like I was a worthless human being and all those other feelings. Listening to your interview thing, like, mm-hmm. that, I related an awful lot with basically all that stuff you said about that. You know, some people, the Mormon paradigm, I guess things work out for them and they say, I am a happy, blessed person and I attribute that to Jesus. But for me, I had the problem, like, I am sad and miserable and guilty and it's all because of religion. And that's how the world works and that's why you're sad and you need to work harder, try harder, do more, be better. You're not doing it right. Whatever it is. But at the same time, I'm having a problem with just sort of my faith overall.
Still on your mission.
Yeah.
Well, probably because you had evidence that it didn't work the way they say it worked.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And like I said, this whole thing about the hand of God, because I've told a lot of people that if I hadn't gone on my mission, I'd probably still be a Jack Mormon. I left the church because I went on my mission, even though I didn't leave, and it was years after that I finally decided I didn't believe it anymore, but, you know, because it's a very long, slow, eroding process. And that's the things, like, you know, like I mentioned this thing when I was 12 and I discovered James Randi, you know, and also the other things, like all this stuff about childhood, and then mission field, it's a sales manual, the mission president doesn't tie to God, this whole thing is, like, a big bureaucratic mess, and there's all these rules we follow that make no sense, you know, all of these problems, and then even just doctrinally, and by the time I was out about 18 months, I was to the point that if any church was true, it was the Mormons. But I wasn't sure that the Mormon church was true.
You had already ejected Christianity.
Oh, yeah. No, the one thing the church is very, very good at is explaining why, and I mean, it's obvious. Just look at Catholicism, how they operate, what they believe, and their history, and it's patently obvious that that is not God's church, right? And any other church. And, you know, and of course, the big trick is you shine that same light on your own church, right. And you go, oh, wait a second. But, you know, and I got to the point where I thought that if the Mormon church had ever been true, it was in apostasy. One of the big cognitive dissonance things that goes on all the time was that I knew before I went out there in proportion to world population growth, the church is shrinking. We're losing. And you go out there with this, the field is white and ready to harvest. These are the last days. The Spirit of God, like a fire, is burning across the land, and you are God's flaming weapon sent out there to reap the harvest, all this stuff. And you're going out there, and just no damn baptisms. The thing is like, oh, we have to reach these people. No, they've been reached. They've heard of us. And they've done some research, and they already know they're not going to join.
Yeah.
And that was one of the big problems. And we all dealt with that, where it's like, wait, if this is the true church, why are we losing the war? So Elder Justin and I have 3 glorious months together. You know, we had this combination of being excellent missionaries while breaking rules. It was so strange. It was absolutely one of the very best times of my life, while at the same time being one of the absolute darkest times of my life. I think it was similar for him, too. 4.5 months before I go home, I get sent to Oroville, California. And I'm there for 6 weeks with young Elder Eric, who was a super pleasant guy. And he had been a meth addict and cleaned his life up and went on a mission. Anyway, we don't need to talk too much about him. He gets shifted out, and I've got 3 months to go. And transfer window comes around, and I get my transfer, and it's Justin. Elder Justin is going to be your companion again.
For a third time?
We lived together. We lived together for like, I don't know, 13 weeks or something. Then we were in the same district, you know, a couple miles apart from each other for like 4 months. We were companions for 3 months, and then we were companions again for another 3 months. And the other thing that was odd is that we were both be finishing our missions at the exact same time.
And would you have been companions, would you have killed each other?
Yeah, it was double suicide. That's what we called it. Justin arrives at the apartment in Oroville, and I remember we didn't even kind of have to bring it up. Sort of the first thing out of our mouths, we had this conversation that's basically, this is our last 3 months, let's do this. We're not going to do Cottonwood again. We're going to be good missionaries, and we're going to work hard, and we're going to fight hard and be brilliant missionaries. And we kicked unbelievable ass. And, like, in my second to last month, we baptized 6 people. The strangest damn thing happened. I'm going to try to tell this story as well as possible while keeping it succinct. Basically, what happened was that this little cabal of leadership in the stake there and in the ward...
Like the stake president and...
Specifically, the cast of characters would be the elders' quorum president, the ward mission leader, the bishop, and the bishop's parents, who were also the former stake president and first lady. Okay. And also... happened to be personal friends another way of the mission president. They got this bee in their bonnet that Elder Justin and I were bad and had to be gotten rid of. And this whole thing starts out where some P-Day, we're over at Elder Quincy's house, he's the district leader, and we're about to leave to go play basketball or something, and he gets a phone call and he goes into his office and closes the door and comes out half an hour later, and we can tell something's up because that's a weird thing, and it's P-Day, and nothing keeps us from basketball on P-Day. And he comes out and he says, okay, elders, that was the zonies, and I know that this is stupid, but I gotta talk to you anyway. And he brings up this laundry list of complaints. Some of them were true and piddling, and most of them were just bizarre fabrications. I don't know, man. He's like, alright, well, I'm not gonna worry about it. Well, there's stuff like, Elder Justin fell asleep at a ward correlation meeting. One of them was that I didn't have my scriptures at a dinner. I went to dinner at the...
So it wasn't... We've heard that you have a TV and a PlayStation in your apartment.
Yeah.
And that you're rollerblading down hills in the evening. It was that you're falling asleep in meetings.
Exactly. That's the thing. It was the most bizarre irony. All our CDs, we packed the CDs away. He packed the PlayStation away. We didn't have a television. We kicked ass. And we worked hard. And we were following all the rules. And we were being successful. Unlike every other missionary that was awesome and followed all the rules, we were actually getting baptism. So anyway, it starts 1 week with the district leader. Next week, we get a call from the zone leader, another laundry list of complaints, and then from the president.
So this wasn't from... Well, you said zonies.
The zone leaders, yeah.
Okay, so these were from other missionaries.
It would just be the chain of command. The people in the ward would complain to the president or somebody, and the president would delegate down. We're working hard and kicking ass, and it was the 4th of July, and it's a P-Day, and I've got like 2 months left to go on our mission, and we're going through all this madness, and I've got like 3 baptisms coming up that week, and we're over at a member's house for the P-Day. They invite us over there for, you know, 4th of July barbecue, and their son was, you know, not a member. He was kind of an investigator. And she gets this call. She's on the phone for 20 minutes, and we're right there in the room with her, and she's looking at us, and we can tell that she is being interrogated about us. And she gets off the phone and says, that's sister first lady president. And I'm like, what do you mean? And she's like, she was asking about you. I'm like what? Asking, do you know where the elders go when they leave your house? Like, what do they do when they're there? Have you seen them doing anything they're not supposed to do? All this stuff. And I just, right there, I pick up her phone, I guess it's the land before caller ID, and I call Sister so-and-so. I chewed her out. I ripped her a new one. Elder Justin chews her out, and then we call the ward mission leader, chew him out. And the next day, we get a call from the AP's elders pack up. So Elder Justin and I pack up our whole lives, and we are just fuming mad because it was all just completely groundless. We drive 2 hours down there. Justin goes in and talks to the mission president. He's in there for an hour, or I don't know who goes. I go in there and I talk to the president for an hour, and he's like, Elder, what's going on? I'm like, President, you know my history. You know I haven't been the best missionary, but I am the best missionary I have ever been. I don't know what these people are about. And he gave me the option of going home 6 weeks early, honorably. And I said, no, President, I've got 6 baptisms lined up this month. I'm doing the best missionary work in my life. I'm not going to have these people ruin my mission for me. And so he's like, all right, we're sending you back.
What was the point of having you pack your stuff?
I think the president was planning, I think he was planning on sending us home. And I think that I talked him out of it because I told him the truth. And this is the faith eroding story. We haul all our crap back in the AP's car, drive 2 hours back to Oroville, and we are just silent. Justin and I are just fuming mad about this whole thing. Because, I mean, you know, like I said, this is the short version. A lot of really messed up stuff happened. So the APs pull into the apartment complex. We haul our hefty bags with our whole lives out of them out of the car. And we're walking up to our apartment that's at the ground level, and there's a staircase coming down. And we're walking into our apartment, and just as we're walking in, there's a guy carrying a TV down the stairs. And he says, you guys want this? And we say, yes.
Is the AP still there?
No, the APs had taken off. They didn't see this. The APs took off. And like, we just didn't even think about it. We're like, yes. I'm telling you, for the last 2 months, we still baptized like crazy, and we worked like crazy, and we played twisted metal, and we listened to rock and roll, and we swam in the big pool and back, because it was hot. It's 110 degrees out there in the summertime, you know? But yeah, we went back to watching TV and playing twisted metal, but also, like I said, we worked our brains out, and from that point, we just had a fuck it attitude. I've never been one to be phony at all. It's always actually been a problem with me that I'm not good at playing roles, but I just put on the face, and I just smiled and I grinned, and I baptized and I was a missionary. But
and that eroded your faith?
Well, just the whole thing where the whole time that we were kind of bad missionaries and all this stuff, kind of nothing happened. We are doing everything we're supposed to do. And what happens? Some people with no business whatsoever. Some of this, I think, might even sound kind of unbelievable. I can even imagine a member going, oh, no, I'm sure that's not how that happened. And so the fact that, like, you know, we go out of our ways to do good, and then we come back there, and after all of this, and after talking ourselves back into this, here comes this guy, says, you guys want a TV? Really? God's going to put that TV right there? And I just realized, no, it doesn't work that way. This whole blessings work, sin, bad things, blessings, good things, it just doesn't bear out. It just isn't the case. And so we freaking checked out. Halfway, I should say. Like I said, we kept working like crazy. That moment, like, broke down this barrier, I think, for both of us, where we just suddenly, that wall was gone, and we just lived both lives and just didn't worry about it. This is where a couple, I don't know, about 6 weeks, I guess, before we go home, there's a couple of young ladies, young recent high school graduates in the ward, and I guess they liked us. You know, in church, we chat with them, you know, we do the whole foyer thing, and we get back to our apartment one day, and these two girls had completely, you know, pranked it, silly string, I don't know what else, everything, spaghetti, all this crap. So one night, like 10:30 at night, we bike out to their place and trash one of their cars, and just kind of started this sort of little back and forth pranking thing that just culminated with one night they knock on our sliding door. They sneak around the back of our sliding door. Like, we just end up staying up all night, lying in bed and chatting with these girls. We did it in proper companionship style, where we're both in the same room. Everybody could see what was going on.
No hanky-panky, just spending time alone with them.
Well, that was the irony, is that, like, at one point we realized that Elder Justin and his girl are snogging full force, and I was like, oh, shit. And I'm thinking, I'm too smart for that kind of thing. Things, it's all kind of a whirlwind. So this girl is this charming, insanely pretty girl who is just completely completely 100% geeked out on me, which is something I had never ever experienced before, or really since. And I just fell in love. And, because, you know, one thing, I felt like up to that point completely unlovable, and I thought, here it is. This is it. This is the thing. This is the girl. And all of a sudden, I'd never imagined that...
You're going to be like your cousins with their perfect, beautiful families.
Well, kind of. Just the fact that a girl is interested in me.
Okay.
Like, over this couple of weeks, we kind of just do this bizarre dating on my mission. So we're super missionary all day, and then we're up all night hanging out and chatting and kind of half-ass dating. It was like a high for a couple of weeks. I'm sure it was, you know, whatever the thing is, when you're in love, your brain chemistry all goes nuts or whatever. This whole thing kind of progresses until one night, and it's 2 days before I fly home. We fly home on a Wednesday, and this is a Monday. I sneak out of the apartment. Well, sneak out. Justin knew where I was going. I said, bye, see you later. And he's hung out with his girl, and I go and meet up with my girl. And one of the other elders had to go home, and so there was an empty apartment that we had the keys to. And me and this girl go over to that apartment and end up sleeping together. And, of course, I have a total crisis because I'm like, well, shit. You'd think you'd have learned your lesson. The first time, yeah. And now I'm an endowed member, temple, I'm a missionary. And it's because it would have been one thing to do it in the middle of my mission and just be like, oh, but, like, to blow it. 2 days. 2 days you could have finished your mission honorably. I feared for my eternal soul. So I fly home, my parents pick me up, hug, hi, everybody's so happy.
And were you just feeling inside?
Oh, God, yes. Mom and Dad, my little sister are there. Drive home, my Brazilian cousins are there, Brazilian food, snacks, hello, how are you, chatting, all this stuff. And then you go to the stake president's office to be released, because all this time I'm still wearing my tag and my tie, because you're still a missionary.
Right.
And I go into the mission president's office, and I have to say that I always had, from beginning to end, incredible leadership. All of my bishops and stake presidents have always been world-class guys. I've got no complaints about any of them. But, you know, Elder Johnson, how are you? President, I got something to tell you. And the look on his face. And
he knew what was coming?
No.
Oh.
He was... so blindsided. That meeting was 180, because that's the other thing, like, for him, like, you know, the fact that I was a prodigal son, like, when I came to, when the bishop cleared me to put in my paperwork and I had to go have my interview with him, and I had my interview with him every week or something, like missionaries do when they're getting ready to go, I kind of wish I could ask him the question, like, what was that like for you? I think I got disfellowshipped right then and there, and I had to go home, and I had to tell my mom. And so, you know, within 15 minutes, South America knew all of it. She's on the damn phone to Brazil, and then so it's like, and I knew that was gonna happen. And that was one thing I just kind of took as right. It's like, all right, everybody's gonna find out. You know, I said present. I was like, I guess I can't have a homecoming. He's like, no. So I didn't get a homecoming. I was disfellowshipped. So, like, I came home from my mission. Proud son of Kearns returns, and it was a bit obvious to everyone very quickly. Something went wrong. The thing that I've been most single-minded and devoted and determined about was my mission, and that's how well I did at that. you know, I was in love with the girl. She ended up moving out. It was all so stupid. At red flags everywhere. I think she saw me as kind of her ticket out of Dodge, I think.
So she moves out here, you guys, you're disfellowshipped, you have to go.
We're disfellowshipped, and we're like, she starts her discipline proceedings and all that, and, you know, and we're like, we're going to be good, and we're not going to have sex, and we're going to, you know, get everything back in order, and then we'll get married in the temple and be good and all that other stuff. You know, and a couple weeks later, I had to go back to the president saying, happened again, did it again, and they started the proceedings, and I was excommunicated. You know, it's funny, afterward, I told people a lot about it. I was like, yeah, I was excommunicated, and they said, for what? And I'm like, fornication. And they said, what? Really? You know, because it was kind of wild, but I think part of it was because of the way I handled it. Because I never tried to hide it. I didn't sit on it. Like, the first time I had sex and sat on it for all those years before I went on my mission, and, you know, it tore me up, and, like, I'd long learned my lesson. Because the other thing, I also had this attitude, and I remember saying this in my disciplinary meeting with the 15, 16 guys in the room. One of them is the nice old guy that's known me since I'm a little baby from across the street. You know, God, it's embarrassing. Well, I remember saying that, you know, I made the promise in the temple. That's the deal. You live by the rules, and if you break the rules, you're subject to discipline, and you take your punishment. I didn't really offer a defense. I said, I screwed up, you know?
And are you still a believer at this point?
Yeah, kind of. Like, it's, I don't know, it's, I guess it's that place where, like, I didn't know, I guess I didn't realize at that point that it was an option not to believe, if that makes sense. You know, and I don't remember too much about the actual disciplinary meeting. Like, I remember there's, ostensibly, there's one guy that's supposed to be your advocate, you know, like, to give it some semblance of not being a kangaroo court. But, you know, I mean, it, I think everything was done by the book, and I can't really have any complaints, you know. I tell them what happened, they say, how do you feel about this, what about your covenants, all this other stuff, and I knew I was going to be excommunicated just because I offered no defense. And they throw me out of the room and put me in a room by myself for what feels like forever. I think it was maybe 30 minutes to an hour, but it felt unbelievably long. And I just sat in that room, wringing my hands and having the dark night of the soul. You know, and because the thing is, I remember having a lot of times on my mission, and even before then, having the thought that I think maybe you might have said this on your podcast, somebody on the Mormon Voices has said things like this, where you kind of have this thought that, like, maybe the terrestrial kingdom's not so bad, or the celestial kingdom.
Choosing.
Yeah, because I just remember thinking, like, so if the celestial kingdom is, like, church, and I hate church, and, like, the whole, like, polygamy thing, like, no thanks, one wife will do, please. And the whole idea is, like, becoming a god. I was intensely uncomfortable with that. I don't want to be president. I don't want to be captain of the team. Don't make me make decisions that matter to other people. Like, you know, the whole idea about being God was so uncomfortable. And there wasn't, I mean, there's no image of heaven that I was ever comfortable with. I remember 6, 7, 8 years old in Sunday school, and they're having the lesson about the celestial kingdom, and they're saying, what's it like? What's it like? I remember the teacher saying, it's like, imagine every free throw in basketball goes in. And I remember saying, won't that get boring? And he said, no, because it's perfect. And I'm like, oh, okay, because it's okay. But I always had that feeling. But, you know, while I'm sitting there in that room going, celestial kingdom it is.
Yeah.
Hoping, I guess, yeah, I haven't seen Jesus, so I can't go to outer darkness. Because that's how that works. Everybody knows that. They pull me back in the room and they say, you're excommunicated. And they give me the letter and the list of things I need to do and set up my weekly.
There's a list of things you need to do?
Yeah, they told me, like, I needed to have a meeting with the stake president every week. I needed to be in church every week.
Oh, so in other words, it's not like, you're done, goodbye. It's, no, you're excommunicated, here's what you and need to get back in our good graces.
Like, I could have been back inside of a year. And they give me the letter, the other thing, and then they have me go sit around for another half an hour. And I remember for that half an hour, I had that same determination. Like, I can fix this. I'm not going to sleep with her again, and we're going to be good. And in a year, we'll get married, or whatever, you know, I'll get rebaptized, and I'll get this all together. And I left the stake center and I drove straight to Walmart and bought boxer shorts. And then I go home and I took my garments off and put all my garments in a cardboard box. And I remember having this enormous sense of relief. This thought of, I have the best excuse ever to never go to church again. I'm not a Mormon. I'm out. Covenants are gone. I'm not a Mormon.
And you don't feel any pressure to get back to where you quote, should be?
I mean, I felt a lot of pressure, I guess. But at this point, my faith had so eroded, you know? And I guess it was probably like 2 or 3 years before I finally decided, oh, I'm an atheist. You know, within a year after my excommunication, you know, I think it was 3 or 4 months, I went and talked to the stake president, you know, every week or every couple of weeks. And, you know, I think I went to church once or twice after I got excommunicated. And I remember having a meeting with the president, and he was talking about, like, you know, you got to come to church, and are you going to come to church? And I remember saying, President, I just don't want to do it right now. And I would say, I remember telling an awful lot of people this, I haven't turned my back on the church. I just don't want to do it right now. I needed a damn break. I guess I went into Mormon retirement. And, you know, within a year or two, I guess I was kind of a deist. And that's where beer comes back up into it. Because, you know, I wasn't a member. And so I started drinking real beer, microbrews. I went to the store and experienced all these beers.
Were they as wonderful as you had?
Oh, yes. Because near beer, I mean, near beer is still preferable to water, for example. But it's crap. It's not good beer. And so I drank beer regularly, but the thing is I had this rule where like I'd only drink two or three. And there was this barrier to getting drunk. I was 25 before I got drunk. And I remember hanging out with my buddy drinking beer. And he's like, you know, he's like, drink more. Like, and he's like, have another beer. And I'm like, ah, I've already had three. I can't have any more. And I don't remember the whole conversation, but I just remember him saying something like, God doesn't hate you because you drink a beer. What, did you drink a beer and you went out and raped somebody? Are you beating on somebody? What's going on? Like, what's wrong with this? And I just remembered, nothing. And that's where that whole James Herriot thing tied back into it. I was like, oh, that's right. You can drink beer and be a perfectly good person. In fact, it might help. You know? I guess I became a deist. I always believed in the Big Bang, old universe. I guess I was a deistic evolutionist, but like I never had any problem with that thing. And I always had majors, like the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve has to be allegorical. But in the middle of all this, my wife was intensely abusive, and that
so,
whole...
So, well, let's develop that story then.
Yeah, let's do.
So you get excommunicated. How soon after that do you find out that she's pregnant?
That wasn't until a few months later. It had been several months. I mean, I absolutely did fall in love with her, but I was a wreck, obviously. I'm certainly not now the paragon of emotional well-being, I guess. I don't know. I feel pretty together. But I mean, at that point, she was terribly emotionally abusive. There's
even
just a lot
you
of
were dating?
Oh, yes. And the thing is, I remember telling her, you know, at one point, like, we'd been together maybe just a couple of months. And I just said, I think that you ought to go home. I'm not saying it's over. I'm not saying let's never see each other again, but like...
This is unhealthy.
Yeah, like, this is obviously bad for both of us. I think you ought to go home to California and I ought to get my life together, I guess. I don't know. I tried to break up with her, but, you know, she played me like a violin. She gets pregnant and then immediately I was just in a mode of like, all right, we are going to get married and we're going to be together forever and we're going to raise this kid.
Okay, so then you were still in this, I believe, but I'm taking a break.
Yeah, I don't know. I was thinking a lot about religion. I think I should say I was thinking a lot about my religion and my relationship with the church and what I was going to do. But it was a lot more thinking about and less thinking about what am I going to do. Like, you know, I remember telling a lot of people for a long time, the only thing that I miss about church is the temple. And then I even remembered when that changed. Because I still kind of had this idea that if there was any place to find truth or value or redemption or anything in Mormonism, it had to be in the temple, right? That's the last place it can be. It wasn't in the mission field. It sure as hell isn't in the chapel, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, the last place it might exist would be in the temple, and of course I wasn't allowed to go there.
You're married by May. How does she... Is she a believer?
She was Mormon because her dad told her she was
right.
Mormon, you know?
So there was no, like... There was not a similar dynamic as between you... You had seen between your parents, where your wife was depressed, and it was because you're a poor priesthood leader, and...
No. It wasn't that like that at all. She was just... But yeah, so the church thing, it really dissipated quickly, and I think a large part of it was because I was also just so distracted by all this other stuff. I didn't even want to think about it. Yeah, so it just kind of eroded.
So you have your son.
Yeah. We were married for a year... And the whole relationship was about 18 months, I guess. We were married for maybe 15 months. And that whole period was just a fog of depression and emotional chaos. You know, it's hard for me to say that I was thinking about anything really coherently during that whole thing. And then she cheated on me and absconded with my kid and divorce proceedings and all that. You know, and I was destitute, couldn't hire a lawyer, and that's the other thing. I mean, she took him to California, and like, I even did fight in the court. I could spend another 2 hours talking about family law and divorce court. At this point, I realized, when I say like I was a deist, is that, I guess I can say this about my relationship with the church. I was at this point convinced that if there was a God, he clearly was not involved or interested in us. That whole hand of God thing. When you're a missionary, you're selling happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you're selling the happiness is that you'll have a great family and everybody will get along. And I remember looking around going, happy family, unhappy family, and everything in between. And happy Mormon family, unhappy Mormon family, happy, you know, unhappy, un-Mormon family, whatever. And I realized very quickly, like, if you eliminate the Mormon, non-Mormon distinction, there's no distinction. You can't tell the difference, you know? And you just look at all of these things, like, wait, how are Mormon lives actually any different or better? Like, if you actually examine it, and you don't see it, other than them saying, I'm so happy because of my blessings, because of the church, and then, you know, but wait. If you take away that and just look at the facts, there's no difference. And I realized, you know, that God obviously does not interested in our lives. I figured if there was any kind of God, some kind of creator, he was impersonal, if he was even a he, like some kind of impersonal thing, ticked the first domino over at the Big Bang, and it's all just been unwinding ever since. I think it was about three and a half years maybe after I'd gotten home from my mission, when I was actually reading The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. I don't even remember what section it was or what he was talking about, but it just felt like he had taken scissors and just snipped the last remaining thread that held me to an idea of deism. I remember a moment, and it was just like the moment when I put my garments in the box, only even more profound. I had this just almost like a spiritual, like a physiological thing that I no longer attribute those things to supernatural things like the Spirit or Holy Ghost, but I felt this relief. And all of a sudden, the universe made sense. Because trying to shoehorn God into a coherent worldview is just, you can't do it. And since then, Mormonism has become so much more interesting to me.
Right? Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. I kind of don't like to say ex-Mormon, because I feel like, in the exact same way that if I went to another country and lived there for my entire life and renounced my American citizenship and never even spoke another word of English, I would still always be an American. There's no way you could shake that. And even if I wanted to divorce myself from my Mormon heritage, I can't anyway, and I don't want to. Mormonism made me. It's the reason I am. My dad was Mormon, and he goes on a mission to Brazil, and that's why he hooks up with my crazy mom and all of that good stuff, and that's why I'm here. Thank God that's not real. That's the other thing that Mormons and all the other religious people don't get, is that when I was a child of God, I felt like nothing, because God created me, and he's got this whole plan, and he's worked out, and I'm kind of part of his machine. Now that I have the view that I am chemistry run amok, and the gigantic 14 billion year old universe with all the suns and stars exploding and planets and everything flying around, that life should arise on any particular little rock around any particular little star, and that the universe should conspire to make one of me. Every single human being, not to mention every other living thing, is such a fantastically unlikely thing as to be nearly impossible, except that it isn't. My life means so much more because I now see it as what it appears to be. I'm chemistry with consciousness. Even more to that, eternal life. I can imagine the distance between me and that tape recorder, and I can imagine walking to the 7 from here, and I can even kind of conceive of driving to Vegas, but like very quickly these distances, it becomes just a blob in your brain, right? But you compare this to eternity, like, okay, so we got, if you're lucky, 80, 90 years on Earth. And then after that, eternity. Well, any amount put into infinity becomes nothing.
Yeah, it becomes, you know, pointless.
My life as a Mormon was meaningless, because what do you do? I come here and I grind out God's plan for him, because he needs me to for some reason. Whereas now, I'm an ape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what I am. I'm an ape. I'm a social creature, and being happy in society makes life fun, and so that's how I'm going to make my life work now, is try to be the best ape I can. Being the best Mormon you can be gets you what? You get to be at church for eternity. Makes no sense anyway. Like, anything, eternity, and also perfection, perfect happiness. You know, like, do you have to poo in heaven? Like, it makes no damn sense. And I like this one where I know I'm going to die better. I mean, one of the big lies of Mormonism is that you can be happy. It's one of the big lies of everything, this idea that happiness is a state that can be achieved and maintained. It's not.
So do you think your life is better outside of the church?
Oh, hell yeah. The Mormons all tell you they're happy. And I would have told you, I'm happy. Mormonism makes me happy. Mormonism has blessed me. All that crap. No, I was miserable. And it wasn't like I became an atheist and instantly became happy. What happened was that, or life satisfaction, enjoying my life, became attainable because I could dispense with all of the paradoxes of religion.
You could start to get rid of the things that didn't make you happy, yeah, instead of having to figure out how to make them work.
You know, the other thing too, that, because like Richard Dawkins made me an atheist with the God Delusion, but after that I read The Selfish Gene, mm-hmm, which is just by all biology. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with religion or philosophy. It's a straight-up biology book, and it's the most intellectually challenging thing I've ever read in my life. And it is the book that the Book of Mormon was supposed to be. That book has affected my worldview more than anything else. I do not look at anything the same way since I read The Selfish Gene. And again, it's just about evolution. It's about Darwinian evolution and the gene-centered view of evolution. Anyway, that book is what the Book of Mormon was supposed to be, the book that changed the way I saw the world. In many ways, it's incredibly depressing because he just hammers it into you that evolution and time is just a millstone.
Yeah.
And it is relentless. Everything gets chewed up by this thing. I'd rather the hideous, awful truth than the beautiful lie. And I've mentioned this to other people before, and they ask me about why I'm interested in religion. I think it's a lot, it probably is a lot of the common thing where how people end up going into psychology, and it's because they're self-diagnosis. But I think a big part of my fascination with religion and why I engage with believers as much as I can is that I'm trying to understand the believer that I was. Because I remember, like, it's so hard to put yourself back there. Because I remember, like, I think to myself, like, how the hell did I do that? Because, like, looking back, I remember always having that thought, like, this is bullshit. And it's patently bullshit. It's obviously bullshit.
And then what happened to that?
And,
where'd it go?
They make you believe impossible things. And in Mormonism, obviously, you are trained. They program you not only is having faith the correct way to view the universe, but it's a virtue. And there's all the stories about, oh, this, look how much faith they show, the whole handcart thing. You know, weren't they so faithful? How those people could imagine that God was watching over them or taking care of them, or that Brigham Young was inspired, or that any of that was a good idea, mm-hmm. you know, all that mm-hmm. stuff. That's the definition. And people say, how does somebody believe that? With faith. But I always struggled mightily with faith. Like, I did not pray much, even on my mission. I always had a very, very hard time praying, and I usually just didn't. I mean, like, the personal prayer, like, I prayed all the time, obviously, as a missionary. You pray. But, like, the personal prayer thing where every night and morning I was supposed to get on my knees and have my conversation with God, I probably did that half a dozen times in my entire mission. Because, for one thing, I just felt stupid. I felt stupid doing it. I also had this whole problem where it's like, you know, well, okay, God, is there anything about my situation you don't know because I'm miserable? I prayed to sleep. Can I sleep at night so that I can get up in the morning and so that my companion doesn't hate me and so I don't feel like shit and all that, you know? As soon as you ask God for something, you've already broken the bargain. It's all paradoxes and you just can't live with it.
So the implications of falling out of the church really then have only been good.
Yeah, absolutely. Since I was excommunicated and all that, and then, you know, everybody knows I'm an atheist now. And, you know, I'm friends with a lot of my cousins and whatnot on Facebook, and I don't know if they've blocked me or not, but I'm sure they would have at some point if they would. I mean, it's clear they know how I feel about church and religion and all that. Church doesn't come up, but I'm still invited to the Christmas party. I, you know, the whole shunning thing, that's not something I've had to experience. I know it does go on, and I know people that have gone through that, but that's, I'm fortunate in that my family is not like that.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't talk about church, but other than that, you know, everything's all right. I was lucky in that. I guess I got out easy. You know, I'd actually not really ever thought about it that way before, because it was hard, but God bless them. Gotta love Mormons. They made me. They made us. My great-grandpa wrote a biography of his dad, and like I said, he had three wives, and he wrote this, I think, in the 60s or 70s. He says something in the book, we might say what you will about polygamy and all this and other that, but there's an awful lot of us that wouldn't be here if not for it, so let's be glad for that at least.
So that's how you feel about Mormonism?
My childhood was miserable because, you know, I was raised by crazy people that made a bunch of crazy people. We're all okay. They're working their lives out, but it was not good. And then church poisoned so much of that and made so many things worse than they needed to be. I mean, the whole way that they played my dad off my mom with the whole thing was like, he's not active and he's your priesthood holder and all that stuff. Among other things, everything else, I mean, all the sexual hang-ups, all the things, the way they mess you up. And my mission, all the awful things that happened there. If I could change it, well, what would I change it to? You know, mm-hmm. What would I be if it weren't for that?
Mm-hmm.
Of course I love, I've got no choice but to be happy with my upbringing and my childhood and that I am who I am. It made me who I am. I wouldn't be who I am without it. Mormons are my people and they're my family. I'm stuck with them, mm-hmm. like it or not. But for the most part, I do like it.
Not been easy. I'm feeling beautiful as I'm.